Stay tuned for African News tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty reporting. Leaders at the G7 summit in Germany are meeting for a second and final day Monday with a focus on climate and energy issues and talks with their counterparts from African nations. Before the summit opened Sunday, U.S. President Barack Obama and German Chancellor Angela Merkel held their own talks where the White House said they agreed that how long economic sanctions against Russia remain in place depends on Russia's implementation of a ceasefire agreement in Ukraine. U.S. President Barack Obama voiced confidence in the fight against Islamic State militants and said the United States will increase aid to Iraqi troops to fight the group as he meets with Iraq's Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi on the sidelines of the G7 summit in Germany Monday.
We have seen successes, but we've also seen setbacks.
President Obama then went on to say,
and I'm confident that although it is going to take time and there will be setbacks and lessons learned, that we are going to be successful. ISIL is going to be driven out of Iraq, and ultimately it is going to be defeated.
The talks come less than a week after Mr. Abadi appealed for more help from members of a U.S.-led coalition that has conducted nearly a year of airstrikes in support of the Iraqi military. U.S. and French officials gave Iraq a vote of confidence after those talks, saying real gains have been made, but also said more equipment and training are needed to bolster an Iraqi offensive to regain territory seized by the militants. On Sunday, Iraqi forces made advances in Baji, the oil refinery town Islamic State fighters seized for the second time earlier this year. This is VOA News. The United Nations is convening its latest round of peace talks with Libya's rival governments Monday in Morocco and expressing the belief that the negotiations will be decisive. The UN mission in Libya has proposed a multi-part plan for a unity government to meld the two factions, as well as a new constitution and plans for elections to take place after it is implemented. Monday's talks will involve the latest draft of that plan, the mission said. The political stability in Iraq has, in Libya, has persisted since longtime dictator Muammar Gaddafi was overthrown and killed in 2011. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan called Monday for his country's fractious political parties to act responsibly in the aftermath of elections that ended his ruling majority in parliament. But financial markets quickly recoiled at that uncertainty. Turkey's currency slid to a record low against the U.S. dollar, and Istanbul's stock market plunged 8%. Mr. Erdogan was hoping for a two-thirds majority in the 550-seat parliament, so Ankara's constitution could be rewritten to switch from a parliamentary to presidential democracy, giving him more power. It was a stunning rebuke for Mr. Erdogan, who said no party could claim a mandate to form a single-party government. A UN commission detailed in a report Monday systemic, widespread, and gross human rights violations committed under the Eritrean government's authority. The country's president listed among those mainly responsible. The UN Commission of Inquiry on Eritrea said it was unable to visit Eritrea and received no response from the government to its requests for information during a year-long process that involved 550 interviews and 160 written submissions. The commission said Eritreans are in need of international protection and called for the world to develop long-term solutions to help refugees. Yemen's president, Abdu Rabu Mansour Hadi, said Monday that UN-brokered talks scheduled to begin Sunday in Geneva will not involve negotiations to reconcile with the Houthi rebels who forced him from the country earlier this year. Comments broadcast by Al Arabiya Television, Mr. Hadi said there will only be discussion of implementing a UN Security Council resolution adopted in April. And the South Korean Health Ministry has announced the death of a sixth person from Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, or MERS. The victim was an 80-year-old man who tested positive for the virus while being treated for pneumonia, the ministry said Monday. 87 people in South Korea have been infected with the disease, according to the health ministry. South Korea has also closed down nearly 2,000 schools. I'm Bob Doty in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
What is happening really is that a lot of the families have seen an unstable situation, you know, 10 years back before the Arusha Accords, and they remember what happened then. They're very concerned that what is happening now is degenerating into more violence. And so what they do is they send the children on ahead of them, sometimes accompanied by a relative, sometimes in a general kind of group. But they arrive in the refugee camps while their parents stay at home to look after their family farm or whatever possessions they may have.
That's Dave Wright of Save the Children speaking about the plight of child refugees from Burundi. Details next.
Also in the news, a UN commission report details systematic, widespread and gross human rights violations in Eritrea. And in the DRC, many questions remain unanswered about a mass grave found earlier this year near the capital, Kinshasa.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Ghana, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on African News Tonight. Our top story this hour: in Burundi, a prominent opposition leader says the presidential vote needs to be held by August. Agathon Rwasa, who is a candidate for the presidency and former rebel leader, also called for the dismantling of ruling party youth militias, the Imbonerakure. He said that would be difficult, in part because, he said, the police are under the control of President Pierre Nkurunziza. Rwasa suggested that international partners be used to help disarm the youth militia. The president's term ends August 26th, and Rwasa says the constitution does not provide for a transitional government.
Escalating political violence in Burundi has forced more than 2,300 children to make long and dangerous journeys to refugee camps by themselves. The international organization Save the Children says that since the end of April, unaccompanied children have traveled for up to 1 week, mostly on foot. Their goal is to reach camps in Rwanda, Tanzania, the DRC, and even Uganda. They anticipate more children will leave Burundi as violence continues in the run-up to the presidential elections, originally scheduled for the end of June. David Wright is the East Africa Director for Save the Children in Nairobi. He explains why so many children are making the journey without their parents.
What is happening really is that a lot of the families have seen an unstable situation, you know, 10 years back before the Arusha Accords, and they remember what happened then. They're very concerned that what is happening now could degenerate into more violence. And so what they do is they send the children on ahead of them, sometimes accompanied by a relative, sometimes in a general kind of group. So they arrive in the refugee camps while their parents stay at home to look after the family farm or whatever possessions they may have. And I think this explains the vast majority of the high number of unaccompanied or separated children that we are seeing in these camps. It really is about a fear that things will get worse, and so their families are preparing by sending their children on advance of any major trouble.
What is the journey like for the children?
While, you know, separated children are at less risk because they are often traveling with maybe an aunt or an uncle, unaccompanied children are particularly at risk because they can, you know, they can be taken advantage of by various militia groups or sometimes local officials or anyone really who would be inclined to take advantage of unaccompanied children. It is fraught with danger. I mean, I'd say very few people listening to the show would imagine sending their children off alone on a very long journey where you cross international borders. Any such journey is fraught with danger, particularly in an area like Great Lakes where there are a lot of different risks to children.
What kind of condition are the children in when they do arrive at the refugee camps?
It does vary. Some children are in reasonable condition, but there is a high level of malnutrition already in Burundi. I mean, it is one of the poorest countries in the world. So we are seeing children come in. Some of them are severely malnourished. Some are what they call moderately malnourished. Initially, there was a very high number of malnourished children coming in, so high, in fact, it actually exceeded emergency thresholds. But fortunately, there has been quite a good response in the camps by the World Food Programme and its partners, and these children are getting fed. And they are also getting supplementary feeding where they are suffering from malnourishment. So the malnutrition rates are coming down, but they're still at quite high levels that, you know, we would describe as alarming. When I was in Mahama camp in Rwanda a couple of weeks ago, what they call the global acute malnutrition rate was at 21%, which exceeds emergency thresholds. So that is something that we would remain concerned about.
You mentioned the camp in Rwanda. What other camps are the children heading to?
Essentially, we've got about 30,000 refugees in Rwanda in total, and then they're also heading to camps of the northwestern part of Tanzania, and I believe there's slightly over 50,000 people there, and then 10 or 12,000 have gone into Democratic Republic of Congo, and even about 8,000 people have gone as far away as Uganda, which actually doesn't border Burundi, but is north of Rwanda, which is on the northern side of Burundi. So it could be a regional crisis if a lot more refugees, you know, do move if further instability, because instability becomes more aggravated over the next few weeks. So we are quite worried about what it might look like in a month's time. It is affecting four different countries other than Burundi, and it's very much at this stage an exported humanitarian situation. And of course, the eyes of the world aren't on this particular crisis. They are on, you know, Middle East, they're on Ukraine, Syria, Yemen. And so we are concerned that if things get even worse, that there would not be an adequate response from the international community, because they are stretched so thin with other crises around the world.
In addition, I understand there's also a concern of fresh water at the refugee camps.
In Mahama, it's proving to be logistically quite difficult. I think it is slowly improving, but when I was there 2 weeks ago, the partner responsible for water, sanitation, hygiene, they had to actually drive trucks 46 kilometers away from the camp, and it is a very bad and poor and bumpy road into that camp. And they have been working on boreholes since, but the kind of geology of the area was proving quite difficult. The situation has improved somewhat since because of the relentless strive for improvement by the partners and the agencies. And so I think, you know, we are now up to a minimum standard of giving the refugees just about enough water. But it was extremely challenging at the beginning. And if more and more refugees coming in, it will become challenging again.
Are the children reunited with their parents at some point at the refugee camps?
It's difficult to say if and when they will be reunited. It all depends on the circumstances of their separation. We would hope, for example, that in the cases where families sent their children on, that eventually there would be a reunification, and there are organizations working on family tracing and reunification. But there are other cases where parents might have been killed, and of course then a reunification is impossible, and then we'd identify a relative, you know, a brother or a sister of the parents, and try and foster the child into that family. We strive for unifying the kids with their parents where it's possible, but oftentimes, you know, we would look for foster families for them.
David Wright is the East Africa Director for Save the Children. He spoke with me from Nairobi.
A UN commission detailed in a report today systematic, widespread and gross human rights violations committed under the Eritrean government's authority, with the country's president listed among those mainly responsible. The UN Commission of Inquiry on Eritrea said it was not able to visit Eritrea and received no response from the government to its requests for information during a year-long process that involved 550 interviews and 160 written submissions. The commission said Eritreans are in need of international protection and called for the world to develop long-term solutions to help refugees. The report says hundreds of thousands of people are fleeing the country. Allegations against the government include an extensive arbitrary system of surveillance that the commission said goes beyond national security needs and leaves Eritreans in constant fear of being monitored.
The report says citizens are enslaved by a system of national service, which it says amounts to forced labor, detention, and absence of leave. Reuters Newswire notes between 6 and 10% of the population left the country. The government refers to all those who leave as traitors and has a shoot-to-kill policy by the military at borders. In addition to the president, the commission identifies what it says are the main perpetrators of rights violations: the Ministries of Information, Justice and Defense, as well as the Eritrean Defense Forces and the Ruling People's Front for Democracy and Justice. Those violations include what the panel calls the organized repression of rights to free expression, opinion, assembly, and religion. The commission says Eritreans accused of crimes are not given fair trials and are subjected to arbitrary detention, solitary confinement, and labor camps. While women in the country face discrimination and violence in all areas of Eritrean society, the report says the ruling party uses fear to keep power and has dismantled or refused to implement reforms to establish a real democracy.
In the DRC, many questions remain unanswered about a mass grave found earlier this year near the capital, Kinshasa. Rights groups and private citizens have rejected the government's explanation for the burial of hundreds of bodies about 80 kilometers from the capital. The discovery of the grave followed violent anti-government protests over changes to election laws. Over 40 people were killed. The group Human Rights Watch is calling on DRC authorities to promptly and properly exhume the bodies. Anaka Van Woudenberg is Deputy Director of the Africa Division at Human Rights Watch. From London, she spoke to VOA's Jody Kapowa.
Well, this mass grave was first discovered in March of this year, so March of 2015, and it came as a huge shock to many of the population in Kinshasa. The government has now admitted that 421 people are buried in this mass grave. It's just on the outskirts of the capital, Kinshasa. The government claims that this is indigent, so individuals who are very poor, whose families couldn't bury them, or perhaps individuals with no families or stillborn children. But all the information indicates that that, in fact, is not the case. It's not normal procedure for such individuals to be buried in a mass grave in the dead of night, which is what happened here. People who've spoken about it have been threatened and have been intimidated, and there's just a lot of question marks around this mass grave. And effectively, what's happened this week is that 34 families who have lost loved ones in brutal crackdowns by the police earlier this year and last year are saying they want the bodies exhumed because they'd like to know if their loved ones are there.
Has any action been taken in this case?
No, so there has been no exhumation of the bodies. What the government have done is they have opened up a judicial inquiry, and they did say when the grave was first uncovered that should there be any question or doubt about who's buried in the grave, that they would be willing to exhume. Now, despite already some family members of disappeared individuals coming forward and saying, actually, we'd like the grave exhumed, they haven't taken any action so far. So these additional 34 families that have come forward this week definitely adds the pressure that there should be a proper exhumation of the individuals in that grave, and that that needs to be done with professional support and advice, probably from the international community, because it is, of course, quite a specialist field to exhume bodies and to be able to identify who's actually buried there.
Now, you had mentioned that people think these bodies are people who, quote, disappeared. Can you give us an idea who these are suspected of being?
Well, earlier this year, there were mass demonstrations in Kinshasa when the president attempted to change the electoral law in a way that would have allowed him to have a third term, something that is not permitted in Congo. The mass demonstrations resulted in a brutal crackdown by the police, and at least 42 individuals died, many of whose bodies frequently disappeared. So loved ones were unable to collect their bodies. The morgues became off limits to human rights activists, to family members, to civil society individuals, and no one really knows where a number of those bodies are buried. And it was a similar tactic that was used in another police operation in 2013 and 2014 when the police cracked down on criminal gangs. Again, lots of individuals who the police assumed were associated with the criminal gangs, but on whom there was often no evidence whatsoever, were dragged out of their homes and shot. And those individuals were then taken away, those bodies were taken away by the police. The families were never allowed access to those bodies. So what family members are now seeing is, are our loved ones buried in this mass grave that the government dug in the middle of the night, away from the eyes of everyone else? Could our loved ones be there? And so that's what the question marks are about, what some of the assumptions are of who might be buried in this mass grave.
And the status of the government investigation?
So far, we've seen no further progress. This grave was uncovered 2 months ago. It was big news in Kinshasa. You know, this is not the way that people in Congo bury their dead. Mass graves are frowned upon, are shocking, as they are in many societies. So 2 months in, no exhumation, no clarity as to who is buried, and the government still sticking to its line that these were stillborn babies and individuals that were poor whose families didn't claim the bodies.
Anaka Van Woudenberg is Deputy Director of the Africa Division at Human Rights Watch. From London, she spoke to VOA's Jody Kapowa.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yahiz Wahib, 20 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Escalating political violence in Burundi has forced more than 2,300 children to make long and dangerous journeys to refugee camps by themselves. And a UN Commission report detailed systematic, widespread, and gross human rights violations in Eritrea. And would like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
The United Nations is convening its latest round of peace talks with Libya's rival governments in Morocco. Officials say they expect the negotiations will be decisive. The UN mission in Libya has proposed a multi-part plan for a unity government as well as a new constitution. In a statement, the UN mission calls on all parties in Libya to shoulder their historic responsibilities to uphold their country's higher national interest. It warns there can be no military solution to the current conflict in Libya. The political instability has continued since longtime dictator Muammar Gaddafi was overthrown and killed in 2011.
The Nigerian army is following through on President Buhari's order to open a command and control center in Maiduguri. The Borno state capital has been a frequent target of Boko Haram militants in the six-year insurgency in the northeast. Colonel Sani Usman is the acting director of the Nigerian army's public relations. From Maiduguri, he spoke to VOA's Jody Kapuwa.
The president, during his inaugural address, he made mention of relocating command and control center to the epicenter of the war front. And in compliance with that directive, the chief of army staff acted in advance and Reiki's recognizance to move to the center for, you know, implementation of that directive.
Any idea how soon more personnel and equipment might be heading to Maiduguri to be part of this command center?
Yeah, the center has taken up already.
What happens at this point, now that the command center is active, what happens from this point on?
The center will serve as a forward command base for the Chief of Army Staff and other service chiefs. And essentially, it is an elaboration of the already existing Army Headquarters command and control arrangement. Invariably, the fight against terrorism and insurgency will just be monitored, coordinated, and controlled from this center.
Now, Colonel, neighboring countries have been helping militarily in the fight against Boko Haram. Will those countries have any representatives at the Nigerian Army Headquarters Command and Control in Maiduguri?
If you recall, we have just reinvigorated the multinational joint task force. The Nigerian is now commanding that task force with headquarters in N'Djamena, in N'Djamena Chad Republic. So basically, that is entirely a separate arrangement or kind of sub-regional arrangement. The headquarters is just to enable the commanders of the Nigerian Army and, of course, indeed, other services to be in close touch with the field, as it is.
As part of the opening of the Headquarters Command and Control Center, has the Nigerian Army reached out to the local community to explain what's in store?
Yeah, exactly. We have done so, and that is why I'm even here in Maiduguri. I came back. Remember, this was my last unit before my appointment, so we have always been in constant touch with all the relevant stakeholders in the community, right from the government and the other segments of the Borno State community, and, of course, Adamawa State, as well as the Northeast.
Colonel, as you know, Maiduguri has been under attack recently. Boko Haram deems that city to be extremely important. How important is Maiduguri to the security of northern Nigeria?
Maiduguri is very, very, very important and strategic. You remember, prior to the insurgency or advance of terrorism and insurgency, Maiduguri has been nicknamed the home of peace. Invariably, every segment of Nigerian society is represented in Maiduguri. Our hope and prayer is that we should be able to kind of bring this insurgency to a logical end so that life will go back to normal. And remember again, Maiduguri, apart from historical relevance and social relevance, it has economic importance to the Nigerian society, not just the Northeast.
Can you give us an update on the latest offensive by the Nigerian army? What are the latest moves against Boko Haram, if you're able to tell us?
The latest offensive is that it continues. You know, all the bastions of the Boko Haram terrorists have been destroyed, and the camps, you know, kind of destroyed. So what remains is their major camp, mostly located in Sambisa Forest, which is the vast acre of land. And the fight is going on, and very soon we will definitely destroy all the camps of Boko Haram terrorists within that Sambisa Forest. The establishment of this center is not to create another layer of command structure, but will just add impetus and renew vigor of Operation Zaman last year, and all aim at bringing terrorism and insurgency to an end.
Colonel Sani Osman is the acting director of the Nigerian Army's public relations from Maiduguri. He spoke to VOA's Jody Capua.
Yemen's President Abdul Rabu Mansour Hadi said today that UN-brokered talks scheduled to begin yesterday in Geneva will not involve negotiations to reconcile with the Houthi rebels who forced him from the country earlier this year. In comments broadcast by Al Arabiya Television, Mr. Hadi said there will only be discussion of implementing a UN Security Council resolution adopted in April that calls for the Houthis to withdraw from areas they have seized and to unconditionally end the use of violence. The Houthis took control of the capital Sana'a in September after a months-long campaign, and in March swept south to the port city of Aden in a campaign that sent Mr. Hadi into exile in Saudi Arabia. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon announced the talks in a statement on Saturday, saying all parties should take part in good faith and without preconditions. He said he hopes the meeting would restart a peaceful political transition in Yemen.
This is African News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Ihe Suhib in Washington. It's 27 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Sports fans, this is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. Please join me Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. And on Fridays, you can also hear my 30-minute show at 17:30 UTC. On the internet, like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. Check voaafrica.com for the addresses and enjoy the show.
This is our moment. We are speaking out to end malaria.
This is DJ Drogba. Malaria is preventable and treatable.
Sleep under an insecticide-treated mosquito net every night. Go to a health center at the first sign of fever for testing and appropriate treatment.
Join me. United, we can beat malaria.
The best footballers must have dedication and teamwork. And to end malaria, we need this same unity. Malaria stops footballers from scoring and children from learning. Join with footballer Didier Drogba.
Malaria is preventable and treatable.
Join with leaders like President Kikwete.
United, we can beat malaria.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz, 49.3 meter band, and...
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Escalating political violence in Burundi has forced more than 2,300 children to make long and dangerous journeys to refugee camps by themselves. And a UN commission details systematic, widespread, and gross human rights violations in Eritrea. Coming up, we'll have music from Ghana, and in our feature segment, Cameroon's farmers benefit from improved cassava varieties. I'm Kim Lewis with the Hayes Wuhi Band. We're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. It's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. And happy Monday, Sunny.
Happy Monday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you are kicking off with Women's World Cup football.
Kim, it's the third day of competition at the Women's World Cup football tournament in Canada. There are four matches on Monday, two in Group C and two in Group D. In Group C, Cameroon kicks off its campaign against Ecuador in Vancouver, Canada. And that will be followed by another match in Vancouver between Switzerland and reigning world champion Japan. In Group D, the Super Falcons of Nigeria, Africa's most successful women's team over the years, will play their opening match against Sweden in Winnipeg, Canada. And that will be followed by another game in Winnipeg between Australia and the two-time world champion United States. Remember, VOA football fans, this is the first Women's World Cup in history being played on artificial turf. And as I said last week, the Sunny Side of Sports is hoping it will be the last. In fact, after outcry from top women's players around the world, the sport's international governing body, FIFA, has pledged that this seventh Women's World Cup will be the last contested on artificial turf. In results Sunday, Ivory Coast, which like Cameroon is making its Women's World Cup debut, suffered a humiliating 10-0 loss to Germany in Ottawa, Canada. It was the second most lopsided scoreline in Women's World Cup history. The two-time world champion German women also own the record for the most lopsided World Cup game, an 11-0 thrashing of Argentina in 2011. In Sunday's big win, Celia Sasic and Anja Mittag both scored hat tricks for Germany. In the day's other game in Ottawa, Norway topped Thailand 4-0. The month-long Women's World Cup began on Saturday in the western Canadian city of Edmonton. Host Canada edged China 1-0 in the opening match, and then the Netherlands beat New Zealand by that same 1-0 scoreline. And speaking of New Zealand, let's go to New Zealand now for an update on the FIFA Under-20 World Cup football tournament for men. African fans have reason to cheer because all four African teams in the tournament, Ghana, Mali, Nigeria, and Senegal, have advanced to the knockout round of 16. Ghana will meet Mali Wednesday in an all-African encounter in Wellington, New Zealand. Also Wednesday, Senegal will go against Ukraine in Auckland, New Zealand. Nigeria's next match is Thursday when it plays Germany in Christchurch, New Zealand. It's a game between the reigning African champion and the reigning European champion. Sam Audu is the media officer for the Flying Eagles of Nigeria. In a phone interview from New Zealand with our friend in Lagos, Shagun Dot on the spot Adeyemi, Sam said there's a lot of excitement in the Nigerian camp ahead of the match against the German boys.
Everybody's excited. We are through to the round of 16, where we're going to play Germany on Thursday in Christchurch.
I'm looking at the results of Germany in the first round matches. Germany beat Fiji 8-1. Beat Uzbekistan 3-0 and hammered Honduras 5-1. Does that bother Nigerian players and officials?
Well, Nigeria, as we all know, they like challenges, and this would not be any different. And also, when you mentioned the likes of Honduras and Fiji, by all standards, they're not world powers. So I will want to look at these results and downplay them. We are really looking forward to the challenge, and I believe it to be a clash of African champions against European champions. And I believe at the end of it all, the African champions will come true.
That was Sam Audu, the media officer for Nigeria's team to the ongoing FIFA Under 20 World Cup in New Zealand. He spoke with me on telephone from New Zealand. In other news, a Nigerian high school student, Chinedu Okolo, has been invited to the South African team that is preparing for the FIFA Under 17 World Cup in Chile later in the year. Okolo, who was born in South Africa, currently plays for the Under 17 team of SuperSport United Club. Chinedu's father, Lawrence Okolo, confirmed the invitation extended to his son.
I feel very pleased and honored. I thank God for the blessings, and I have no doubt in my mind that the boy will do well. He has been a good boy, well behaved, and he has been fighting hard to do his best.
Finally, athletics. Kenyan runners Ibrahim Cherubin and Rose Chelimo won the top honors at the Matoni Cheske Bidovice Half Marathon in the Czech Republic on Saturday. Cherubin, the fifth fastest of all time at the distance, won the men's race in 61 minutes and 24 seconds. In the women's race, Chelimo maintained her impressive form by winning her fourth half marathon of the year in 72 minutes and 1 second. After the race, the energetic Andy Edwards spoke with women's title winner, Rose Chelimo.
You won outside 72 minutes. I think it showed that it was really warm conditions. Did it feel like that?
Yeah, it was very hot, and the weather was too hot, and the race was tough. And I managed to make it to be the winner of the day.
Also, this is your fourth win in 2015 at half marathon, and it also includes winning Lisbon, which is always a very high-class marathon, a half marathon rather, at the end of March. Did you set out to plan this? Because I don't think you've ever run as so many half marathons and won so many in a close time.
I had to rest because I ran in Lisbon in March, and then I rest for 2 months without a rest, and then for now, this is June, I ran this for Czech Republic.
What's next for you? Because you've won four. Are you going to have a rest and then set other targets? And if so, what are your other targets for the rest of the year?
No, so for now I'm going to have a rest, and then from there maybe I can prepare for 10K.
Do you have marathon ambitions? I mean, you're looking at what you do on the shorter distances. What could you do? I mean, 68 to 20-something, 22, in fact, your personal best to win Lisbon end of March. That's good running.
Yeah, for now, marathon, I've not prepared yet. Maybe in 1 year time, I'll run marathon.
Many thanks for that interview, Andy. Thanks so much for listening. For the Sunny Side of Sports, this is Segun Adeyemi in Lagos.
This is Africa. Zamina, mina, waka, waka, Zamina, mina, sakalewa. This time for Africa.
I'm very, 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 very excited. Ni chabulile.
Hola. Cause this is Africa. Zamina, mina, waka, waka, Zamina, mina, sakalewa. This time for Africa.
The Sunny Side of Sports welcomes your comments. You can send me email at sunny@voanews.com. Sunny is spelled S-O-N-N-Y. And pick up a pen or a pencil and a piece of paper. My full postal mailing address is The Sunny Side of Sports, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue Southwest, room 1613, Washington, D.C., 20237.
Playing basketball. We love that basketball.
The National Basketball Association Finals between the Golden State Warriors and the Cleveland Cavaliers is now even at one game each. In Game 2 Sunday night, the Cavaliers scored a big 95-93 road victory in overtime in the western U.S. city of Oakland, California. Superstar LeBron James turned in another electrifying all-around performance, tallying 39 points, 16 rebounds, and 11 assists. Yes, VOA basketball fans, that's what we call a triple-double. Double figures in three different statistical categories. Stephen Curry, Golden State's league most valuable player, is known for his sharp shooting from long range, but he shot poorly Sunday night. In fact, Curry set a new NBA Finals record for missed shots from three-point range. Steph missed 13 of the 15 shots he took from beyond the arc. Game 3 in the NBA Finals will be Tuesday night in Cleveland, Ohio. The Cavs will be playing the rest of the series without All-Star guard Kyrie Irving, who shattered his kneecap in Game 1, and he'll be sidelined 3 to 4 months. But even without Irving, LeBron seems determined to make this a very competitive NBA Finals. Turning to tennis, here's a sunny side of sports salute to Stan Wawrinka of Switzerland and Serena Williams of the USA, who won the men's and women's singles titles at the French Open. Ladies first, Serena lifted the trophy for a third time after she beat Czech player Lucy Safarova in three sets. It was her 20th Grand Slam singles title. And after winning the Australian Open earlier this year, the 33-year-old Williams now has her sights set on winning Wimbledon and the U.S. Open and completing a calendar year Grand Slam, perhaps cementing her status as the greatest female player of all time. On the men's side in Paris, Wawrinka upset world number one Novak Djokovic of Serbia in four sets. It was Wawrinka's second Grand Slam title. He also won the Australian Open last year. Finally, here's another sunny side of sports salute to the Bay Colt American Pharoah, who made history over the weekend at the Belmont Stakes horse race in New York. American Pharoah, ridden by Mexican jockey Victor Espinoza, became the first horse in 37 years to win all three jewels in the Triple Crown of American Thoroughbred horse racing: the Kentucky Derby, the Preakness Stakes, and the Belmont Stakes. Go American Pharoah! I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Yehias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny, and listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
Coming up, the first part of a series on throwbacks to Johannesburg's distant past. And next, across sub-Saharan Africa, access to enhanced planting material resilient to drought and pests. But first, some music from Zambia. Here is J.K. Danny with Leka Sambe.
Boy, hola, wabaza sana, le mona shine. Yose kula imbafi, too much of anything is bad.
Leka Sambe, boy, kukataife, paka sande, Leka Sambe.
Shit, boy. Vaza ziba banji balange.
That was Zambia's Danny Kaye with Lekasambe.
Well, Johannesburg is one of the most modern cities in the developing world. Super chic malls selling international designer brands dot the metropolis, with more being constructed. While some residents bemoan the city's loss of individuality, there are a few businesses that refuse to disappear into the morass of modernity and uniformity. Darren Taylor reports in the first part of a series on throwbacks to Johannesburg's distant past. Today he looks at a tailor's shop that's been in the middle of the busy city for over 100 years.
It's a dark and crisp winter's morning on Albertina Sisulu Street in central Johannesburg. Chiman Chiba opens the tangle of locks and chains that secure his tailor shop. He lifts shutters of rolled metal to reveal windows displaying rabbit fur hats and designer shoes. Chiba is a small man of 76, but feisty. How else could he have thrived on these streets that seem to grow meaner by the minute? He describes how a gang of robbers recently descended on his store.
Actually, they came with a firearm, and we were about six of us here. And they just cocked the gun, and they said, it's a hold-up. But we are fortunate. We can only thank Almighty.
Inside the cramped and dingy tailors, there's a fresh fabric smell of new clothing. Hundreds of pants and jackets hang from walls.
There's an old man's picture there on the side.
Chiba points to a crumpled, faded black and white photograph on his desk. In it, an elderly man swathed in a patchwork robe smiles benignly. It's his father, Ramji, who opened R. Chiba Tailors of Distinction in 1914. 13 years after arriving from India in a Johannesburg booming because of gold mining.
And we are a family of 10, six sisters, four brothers, and one breadwinner. Things were tough, no doubt. It was a very hard time, and we survived.
The family stayed in a tiny apartment near their patriarch's shop.
Jordan has got two back on the leg side, some opposition.
Chiba keeps one eye on a cricket game on TV while remembering how the skyscrapers of the inner city rose around him and his siblings in the 1940s.
All these buildings came out in front of us. I remember while they were digging in the hole, we used to jump in, play. All these buildings came out while we were here.
Chiba began working as a tailor when he was 14, 62 years ago.
Ever since then, I'm still here. Still alive, live and kicking, and the beauty part, I enjoy my work. Not a day we have stayed away. We are four brothers. We are working together, all in one business.
Two of his brothers died a few years ago. Now we're short of manpower, Chiba says softly. He adds that the modern world no longer has a place for the art of tailoring.
It's completely dead, you can say. It's not dying trade, but it's dead now. Before, you could find tailor practically every block. Now it's difficult to find a tailor. There's hardly any tailors left. This is all our stock. The jeans and all that stuff, all the work.
To make a living, Chiba now sells ready-made clothes imported from around the world. Now, he says, stores no longer cater to individual customers. A walk down the street shows franchise shops all selling the same branded clothing. Chiba sighs. Clothes used to be a celebration of individuality. Now, everyone wants to look the same. But every so often, he fires up his old, chipped, black Singer sewing machine and does a few alterations for clients. It reminds him of a life lost in the haze of time when he made bespoke suits from material imported from England.
I was actually a machinist, sewing trousers and a jacket. Men's clothing only. Only jacket, trousers, waistcoats. 99% of our clients were coloreds and Africans.
Chiba says he always loved making clothes, even though it was tough work.
Because we used to get so many trousers a day, we have to finish. So we were on the machine all the time. We had no time to loaf or anything. And we had no such thing as a lunch break or anything.
He acknowledges that soon he'll have to retire and Chiba Tailors will shut for good.
There's nobody to follow. Our children are all in a different field, all in the computer field, IT and so forth.
Right now, though, he and his brother continue to work as hard as ever.
Up till now, we're working 12 hours a day. 12 hours a day.
Chiba is resigned to his store being absorbed into modernity. He smiles weakly and says it'll probably become a fancier place, selling fancy stuff that all looks the same. Or worse, a fast food outlet. And yet another grain of Johannesburg's rich history will be gone forever. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
Increasingly unpredictable climatic trends, a number of cassava growers across sub-Saharan Africa remain confident. Long years of scientific research have finally granted them access to enhanced planting material resilient to drought and pests. For many growers of the staple, it is a fresh dawn, as Enterique Divine Jr. reports from Douala in Cameroon.
Usually, the rainy season begins in March, but this year, farmers are watching and waiting. Rain is sporadic, and when it does come, it drizzles. Growers of maize, yams, beans, and vegetables are scratching their heads, but the country's cassava farmers remain at ease.
I no longer bother much about delays in rainfall.
Eukaria Mimba is a smallholder cassava grower in Yabasi, a locality nestled deep in the equatorial forests along Cameroon's coast. 2 years ago, she was among thousands of farmers nationwide who embraced improved varieties of the tuber. She says she does not regret her choice.
The species I currently plant are far better. They yield better, are resistant to diseases like cassava rot, grow in poor soils, and even under harsh climatic circumstances. Besides, I don't need fertilizers.
Her satisfaction is the fruit of research masterminded by the Nigeria-based International Institute of Tropical Agriculture, IITA. So far, some 80 improved varieties suited to different ecological zones have been developed and are being distributed to African farmers. Work undertaken by Senegalese national Papa Saliu Sarr, a researcher with the Kyoto University in Japan, helped bring high-yielding cassava plants to eastern Cameroon 3 years ago.
The improved varieties that we introduce in the area can go up to 30 tons per hectare, while the local variety can give about maximum 10 tons per hectare. So the production is 3 times improved.
And that's not all. The list of upgraded varieties includes strains that meet the aspirations of both smallholder and large-scale growers. Researcher Emmanuel Chukudi is an IITA representative in Burundi.
Farmers, they want varieties that are intercrop with their different crop like groundnut and maize. Then there are some other people who are for large-scale production. But there are some varieties that we are producing now that they can harvest at 9 months after planting. We notice that farmers at times prefer early maturing variety, that is for income. Then since they also want to keep cassava in the field for food security, then we have also varieties that can be harvested at 24 months and they don't get any rot in the ground.
Last year, Cameroon grew 2.5 million tons of cassava. And with production likely to increase, businesses dealing in starch, liquor, flour, animal feed, and ethanol production are paying close interest. Rashid Hanna is the IITA resident representative in Cameroon. He says the future for cassava has never been so bright.
Now they want to use cassava flour to be included in bread. So now, not only cassava is being produced for consumption, but as well as for industrial usage. That's a good start.
As growers' fortunes improve and food security gets a boost across the continent, several challenges remain. The early maturing species begin rotting within days after harvest, and farmers are demanding better farm-to-market roads for quick transport of their yield. They also want to see the stepped-up distribution of new varieties and more conveniently located processing plants for cassava. For VOA News, I'm Tarika Devon Jr. in Douala, Cameroon.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up with this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Kwame Afori, and our engineer, Jonah Cummings, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Though it faces a food security crisis that threatens more than 4 million of its people, the government of South Sudan took the extraordinary and regrettable step of expelling the top United Nations official working there to help address the emergency. The government of South Sudan indicated that the decision to expel UN humanitarian coordinator Toby Lanzer came after remarks Lanzer made in a television interview regarding the gravity of the humanitarian crisis facing the country. The humanitarian crisis is the direct result of ongoing fighting between the government and opposition forces that began in December 2013, when a political split between President Salva Kiir and his former Vice President Riek Machar erupted into violence. The United States condemns the decision to expel Mr. Lanzer. The action is an affront to the international community working to bring peace and stability to South Sudan. It also demonstrates a callous disregard for the suffering of the South Sudanese people. The government's priority should be bringing an end to the violence that has already displaced more than 2 million of its citizens, half a million of whom are now refugees in neighboring countries, and left 4.6 million facing extreme, life-threatening hunger. The United States has contributed more than $1.1 billion in emergency aid to house, feed, and provide medical services for the people of South Sudan, as well as improve water, sanitation, and hygiene services. We strongly support the work of the UN mission in South Sudan and that of Mr. Lanzer, who has been instrumental in addressing the dire humanitarian needs of conflict-affected communities and has been a strong partner and advocate for vulnerable populations in South Sudan. We join UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon and other governments in calling on the government of South Sudan to reverse its decision and to cooperate fully with all United Nations entities present in South Sudan, as well as other international organizations working on behalf of the South Sudanese people.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.
Everyone is looking for something special when maybe they should just listen instead. The VOA's African Music Mix will soothe your nerves and calm your head. Tune in from 0 to 300 UTC and 1100 to 1300 hours UTC to make you feel good. So treat yourself to that something special.